We are going to talk about a couple things today. So first, I want to talk about ML. So you already had a reading, you had to start, and hopefully the quiz wasn't too horrible. ML, just so you know, it's a pretty foreign-looking language, right? I think the reaction that most people have, in fact, I actually very clearly remember what my reaction was when I saw ML. It was like, there doesn't seem to be enough there, right, to actually describe some kind of program. And we'll talk about that a little bit, but that's actually now what I love about it, is that it really only kind of says what's essential. So we'll talk about the history of this language family, because it's actually been very, very influential. And then we'll talk about the specific one that we're going to use in this class, which is called F-sharp. F-sharp is kind of a modern take on ML. Okay, so things coming up. Obviously, you have a lab. Lab 1 is due on Sunday. This is a partner lab, so feel free to work with somebody if you want to. You can work on your own as well. And we'll have I'll post a new quiz on like Friday or Saturday for you to do next week. Okay, so announcements. We have a colloquium tomorrow, so if you haven't been to colloquium yet, that would be a good time to start coming. If you're taking 334, I assume you're like committed to the major. So just so you know, you have to take 20, you have to go to 20 colloquia before you graduate. It is actually a graduation requirement. So in any case, I thought I'd mention this person. This is Ina Fitterow-Brostian. She's at UMass Amherst right now. And she does this really interesting work on trying to diagnose Alzheimer's disease using machine learning, like trying to push the diagnosis earlier and earlier. So this should be an interesting talk. If you like machine learning, or if you kind of have a theory bent to your interest in computer science, you might actually really, really like this one. But it's interesting because not only does she do this sort of like fundamental machine learning stuff, she has this really impactful application that she works on. So, okay, let's talk about ML. So the first thing I want to say is, really, ML is, okay, it's going to be foreign, but just kind of be ready for that. And what I want you to keep in mind is just kind of like free your mind, okay? So this might look familiar to you. This is sort of the theme of the class, okay?
You have to let it all go, Neil. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind.
Okay. By the way, that's the height of his acting skill, just so you know. I love this movie, but, you know, I think, whoa, that's like his, you know, go back to Bill and Ted's. It's where he refined his whoa skills. But, you know, okay, so we're not going to be jumping off of buildings here, hopefully. but, like, really, you know, one of the things that you probably, I'll just use my experience as a kind of a guide. There were things that I thought must be true about programming because I had learned them with a different programming language. Like the programming language that you kind of learn first, that's kind of what fixes in your mind what it means to program. Just, you know, we're going to throw that all out, okay? And what we're going to do is we're going to go back and ask what really is necessary to program. And ML really is a total reimagining of this. This was built from the ground up from a very interesting theory. We'll talk about the theory after. The theory is called the lambda calculus. And, you know, the lambda calculus is even weirder. But the thing is, once you get used to thinking this way, it will actually simplify and clarify what it means to write programs. And so for me, I'm actually in this scenario now, which I love, which is programming in ML actually helps me think. So if I'm having trouble just understanding what it is I'm trying to do, I'll actually sit down and write the ML program first. And then I often, because I have people in my department who really like Python, I will then go and write the Python program second. Because Python doesn't help me think, actually. It looks simpler, but it's not, actually. Okay, so where does ML come from? Well, there was this sort of amazing event that happened in the 1950s, which was Lisp. Lisp was the first language that was based on this thing called the lambda calculus. We'll talk a little bit about Lisp later. And Lisp is a very interesting language. But it all kind of stemmed from that, and it was this idea of what we call functional programming now. So I'm not going to define functional programming just yet, because I want to give you lots of examples. And then as we talk about these examples, and you sort of see why they're weird or different, then I will help you kind of shape a cohesive idea of what it means to be a functional programming language. But ML was largely derived directly from Lisp. It was like, okay, we really like this idea, but there are things about Lisp that we don't want, that we want to improve on. As you can see over the years, there were many other languages that were developed that were inspired by ML. And the one that we're going to study is this one, called F#. And so F# really actually kind of came out of these two communities, OCaml and Haskell. Haskell, just so you know, is like the research language in my area. But for very pragmatic reasons, the people who worked on this, they worked at Microsoft. Microsoft said, yeah, you can work on a language, but, you know, we have to be able to actually send it to customers, right? Like, you can't just tinker forever. You have to make something that works for real. And the thing that worked for real at Microsoft at the time was C#. So they said, has to be able to reuse some of the features that we have in C#. And they said, okay, that's what we'll do. So what I like about F# is not only does it have these kind of amazing, beautiful ideas that come from ML, but it's very pragmatic because it has the standard library that C# has. C#, just so you know, in case you're wondering, directly inspired by Java. Microsoft was sued over its similarity. It's now not exactly the same language, but for a long time it was exactly the same language. So, all right. So, where does it come from? Well, there's this interesting guy. His name is Dana Scott. He was a logician, and he had this sort of question, which was, so he's famous for many, many, many things. He won a Turing Award. But the thing that he invented was this thing called the logic of computable functions. He was a logician. But what he really wanted to know was, can we automate proofs? You might have had this thought. Proofs stink, right? They're hard to write. And it seems that computers help us with all kinds of things, right? We can use computers for arithmetic, right, to compute, you know, tables of numbers. We can use them to multiply. We can use them to do all kinds of things. But we can also use them to do, like, a little bit more, as you can see, right? You've used computers for lots of things. They can actually help us reason about things on some level. So I think it's a fair question. Can they also do proofs? And so he really wanted to know the answer to this question. So it turns out the answer is yes, they can do proofs, sort of. And there's a way to think about it. It's to think of it as a search problem. Okay, now if you take the AI course that we have here, is anyone here in AI at the moment? Okay, all right. Here's the dirty little truth about AI. It was a little disappointing on one level to learn this when I learned it, but it is also kind of amazing now that you know it. It turns out that all artificial intelligence, we're not talking about machine learning now, is just search. It's basically the moral equivalent of a mouse trying to find cheese in a maze, right? And so if you can write an algorithm to find for a mouse, like a computer mouse, not this one, you know, but like a little mouse robot, to find cheese in a maze, you can solve problems in logic. So it turns out that's basically the same thing. It's the same, these problems are reducible to each other, which is kind of amazing, right? It's like, wow, how is that, right? So that's a really deep and interesting insight. And so he was actually able to, you know, he came up with this idea, logic of computable functions. It seems like we can solve proofs on computers, but can we really? Let's implement it. It turns out there's a little catch here. Proof search is hard. And by hard, I mean actually computationally hard. If you've taken 361, well, you've all taken data structures, so you know about asymptotic complexity, right? But it turns out there's this class of problems that are incredibly hard to solve, like computationally. And they're what are called NP-complete problems. I'll just give you a hint about what this class is. It basically means that finding the solution is very difficult. Could be exponential time, okay? Verifying the problem is easy, right? So somebody can come up with a proof. That takes a really long time to find. But once they have one, you can just check it easily, right? So it actually makes sense, right? Because proofs often have this character, right? Where you know, you're so just so you know, when you take all those math classes or philosophy classes, and the professor gives you a really hard proof, you know, and then they whine about having to read 20 proofs or 30 proofs from other students. Just remember, finding the proof is hard. Checking it is easy. Right? So this is actually a fact. So here's the thing, though. So it's very hard. Exponential time means it could run Like, it could take so much time that it doesn't finish before we die, right? It's kind of an important practical consequence of that the complexity of that problem. But it turns out many of the things we, sort of daily things we want to prove, work in practice as long as you're kind of steering the process the right way. In artificial intelligence, they call these things heuristics, okay? The word that Dana Scott used was this thing called tactics. Okay, why am I telling you all this stuff? What does this have to do with programming languages? Well, the short answer was, how do you program these tactics? How do you program a proof? And the answer was, somebody had to implement it, and that person was this guy, whose name was Milner, Robin Milner. Okay, so Robin Milner, he was kind of brought in, and he said, how am I going to program tactics? Like, how practically do we do that? And he said, well, you know, it's kind of funny, because a proof is sort of like a program, so how do we program programs? Like, how do we program programming languages? Like, we need something sort of meta on some level. We need to be able to talk about the things that a program can do. So we need some kind of meta language. And that's actually what ML stands for, meta language. Okay? So this was created in 1973. Now, this is really early on in the kind of history of computation, right? I don't know if you know what computers looked like in 1973, but they were big, right? Personal computers had not yet been invented. There was this revolution at the time, something called a mini computer, which was merely the size of this desk, right? And so, you know, they were able to do this kind of work because mini computers meant they could finally, every lab could have its own computer. Awesome, right? And, you know, grad students could spend the evening, you know, tinkering with the computer and coming up with cool ideas. And so Robin Milner came up with this cool idea of ML. And I just want to point out that Robin Milner is kind of special because he really did not have any interest in computer science at first. When he encountered a computer the first time, this is what he said. Programming was not a very beautiful thing. I resolved I would never go near a computer in my life. Right? So here's somebody who was kind of dragged unwillingly into this. And his, you know, we've talked a little bit about aesthetics in this class. We're going to talk more about it. But this was a major driving force for him. He had this kind of mathematical way of thinking about things. But he, you know, he would say, here's this beautiful idea, but when we turn it into something that works on a computer, it's totally ugly, and I can't see how they're related to each other at all. And so, you know, one of the things that he had, one of the criteria that he had, was that beautiful ideas, right, beautiful kind of mathematical ideas, should look like beautiful programs. And maybe ugly ideas or ugly algorithms, maybe at least they're interpretable on some level, right? And I don't know if you've had this experience, but like for me, programming in Java, even a really beautiful idea, a good example is Quicksort, which I think is amazing, right? It's a really cool algorithm. It looks horrible in Java, right? You can't just look at it and say, oh, that's really cool. You kind of have to think about it. And so this is the thing about ML that makes it special, is that just looking at it can often tell you if something is elegant. Okay. All right, so where does F-sharp come in? Well, there's this guy named Don Syme. He was working at Microsoft Research. He had been programming. You know, he went to university and he learned ML, and he said, this is really cool, nice niche idea. You know, no one was really using ML in the real world. But then he started working at Microsoft, and he said, you know, I really hate these programming languages that we have. Like, ML is just kind of more fun than the ones that we're producing. And he somehow managed to convince people that they should let him make a new language. And so he did that. He took ML and he kind of fused it with C#. And then this language is still actively developed, just so you know. It continues to borrow interesting ideas. It's an open source language, so it's probably not going to die. You know, if Microsoft decides to abandon it, it'll continue to live. So I like it. And just so you know, it's used kind of in the real world. Interestingly enough, all of Walmart.com runs on top of F#. I know this because there's a Williams alum who works there who told me this. And here's another organization that runs entirely on ML, not F#, but another variant called OCaml, which is Jane Street. So, by the way, we have a pretty good rate of conversion from this class to Jane Street. They apparently have this class on their radar now, because very few people actually learn ML as undergrads. Okay, anyway, so let's start talking about the language. We'll talk about the most basic things first, you know. Okay, we often want to do logical things in ML. in a program. So let's talk about logical operators. And the reason I want to kind of show you these is that because these are a common source of confusion. Okay, so suppose we want to do and. Okay, it looks kind of like the one we've seen before, and. If we want to do not, this is where things start to get a little weird. It's not, right? It's not the exclamation point that you're used to. If we want to do equals, it's just equals, okay? And the reason this works is that, and you might have noticed, working on your little starter assignment, that we also use equals here. And you might be thinking, this is a different equals, right? Because we're sort of assigning something, right? Well, actually, they're not different. They are the same. And the reason for that is, what we're doing here, we're not assigning 1 to x. We are defining x as 1. So x equals 1. That's what we're saying, okay? So actually, equality is the same thing everywhere because in a functional programming language, there is no assignment, okay? You literally cannot, I don't know if you noticed this in the handout, you can't write this now, right? You cannot do that. You're not allowed. You already defined x. So x is 1, okay? So this is a little bit of a concept that's hard to understand, but it has really important consequences. You probably know from a math class you've taken before that equality is transitive, right, in mathematics. Well, it's not in a normal programming language because normal programming languages don't have this duality, right, between equality and definition, but F-sharp does. So if you say something like this, right? Well, y is also 1. You've defined it as 1 because the quality is transitive. Okay? So here's not equals. Again, some weird syntax. And then, of course, you have some inequalities, right? These are Boolean operations, just like they are in any other programming language. Okay. Everybody clear about this so far? Good. Okay. All right. You might have encountered this weird thing already, tinkering with this. Hopefully, you have downloaded the .NET runtime, and you've opened up the interpreter, something I call a REPL, right? So read, eval, print loop. And you have started at least trying to type some things in, and you might have seen this thing pop up. So unit means nothing. You might be thinking, why do we need that? That's a really weird value to have. So it's a value that means nothing. Okay, so let me just explain why you need unit. This look familiar to everybody? This is Java, right? So what does main return? Nothing, right? And we call it void in main. Okay, well, here's sort of the moral equivalent of that in F sharp, right? It's basically the same function. It's a bit simpler. It seems like it's missing some pieces. You'll see that it's not really missing any pieces as we kind of get comfortable with this. But this is basically the same thing. And we can kind of flesh it out. Like, we can add types. We can explicitly add type annotations. And now it looks a lot more similar. But, so remember this thing. This is a thing that is true about functional programming languages, is that every expression, every single one of them, has to return a value. So if this function above, this Java program, is supposed to return a value, we call it void here. We have to return something in F sharp, but that something is nothing, okay? So we're returning a value that means nothing. So, right, it can't really return nothing, so we have a value that means nothing. And that's basically the idea. Okay, so where does unit come up? Like, how do you get a unit, first of all? You know, clearly I can say this function returns a unit, but like, how do I actually get a unit? Can I assign it to things? Can I pass it as an argument? Yes, you can do all those things. Here's how you get a unit. So you start up, first of all, hopefully you know that you can start up the REPL this way, right? And you might think, okay, I'll type in unit and see what I get. Well, that doesn't work, right? Because unit is actually the name of the value, the type of the value. It's not the actual literal value itself. But it turns out this is how you get a unit. It's just open, close parens. Now, there's good reasons for that. You're giving me this face. You're like, ah, that's. You have like a visceral reaction, like, no. So yes, so that's how you get a unit, open and close parens. And there's a good reason for that, as you'll see later when we talk about functions. But that's how you get one, okay? Now, I kind of glossed over this one tiny detail a little bit just a second ago, which was, okay, I'll come back to that in a second. But I just want to point out that if you have a function, so here's a regular function, right, foo, and it takes nothing, but it returns 2. So we call this maybe a constant function. But notice its type literally says, it takes a unit and it returns an integer, okay? So there is actually like a difference between when you write something like this, right? From a mathematical standpoint, they're sort of the same. If you think about it for a second, a function that takes nothing and returns a constant is sort of not a function, right? It's really just a variable. But you can tell, F sharp, that you really, really, I want this to be a function. Please make this a function. And the way you do it is you say, well, it's going to take a unit and then return nothing. And that's why when you get the type of this, what you get back is unit int. Whereas down here, you just get int. Because this is a function, this is just a variable. Yeah? That one.
Normally, when you're defining a function, you have, say, the function, a space, and a parameter, right?
Wait, say that again.
Like, if I wanted to pass some integer, I'd say, like, foo, space, var.
Yeah.
So why is this a special case where it's, like, right next to the thing?
Oh, I mean, you can put a space here if you want to. You can totally, you mean like just insert a little space here?
Yeah.
That's also the same thing. Yeah. There's no special case. I happen to draw them next to each other. But here, let me show you. In case you don't believe me. Let's go over to our, by the way, feel free to interrupt me and ask questions like this all the time. So, all right, so I'm going to start this up. All right, so let foo 2, that's what I wrote in the slides, right? Can everybody see this all right? Okay, and Nachman, your question was, is this a special case because I omitted the space? And the answer is no, watch what happens. It's exactly the same thing. Is that what you meant?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, no, the language doesn't care about spaces, really. Is there something else that do you have a follow-up question, or are you good? Okay, all right, Emma.
Maybe you were just using this for like demonstration or something.
Yeah.
But when would you want to have that as
That's a really, really good question. Let's return to that later. The short answer is, if you can't think of a reason to do it, you shouldn't. There is a good reason, but we'll talk about that later. It has to do with something called side effects, but I don't want to talk about side effects just yet. Atlas.
Does foo the function in foo 2, like if we did like a logical check?
Oh. You mean the function itself. So like, okay, let's do some checks here. This is a good question. Let's call the one that's not a function bar just so we can distinguish between the two. Okay. And we'll start with something that should obviously be true, right? So we want to know if bar equals 2, right? So here's a logical check. And the answer is yes, right? Great. Your question is, does foo the function now equal 2? What's your guess?
I
want
to say no.
No. And you are correct. It is not. And the reason is that, and in fact, this complains about this being a type error, right? Because the thing, I don't know if you know this rule, this is sort of true in many programming languages, but, you know, for many operations, you know, the left-hand side has to have the same type as the right-hand side. Right, and for most comparisons, that's the case. So in this one, right, we have an integer over here, and then we put foo over here, and this happens to be a function from unit to int. And so these two things aren't the same, and the type checker is just going to be like, wait, what are you asking me? This doesn't make any sense. So not only is it not equal, it doesn't make sense to the language. Good. Good question. Okay, good. Other questions? All right, great. So I wanted to show you kind of another thing about this, which was, okay, so here's us calling it, right? Suppose we want to ignore the output of a function. There's a function called ignore that we can call, which is interesting, because what it does is it converts it into something that returns a unit, right? Sometimes we want to do something, and we want to throw the result away. And I'll give you an example. Suppose you have a function that returns a tuple, and you only care about one side of it. On some level, you want to ignore one side of that tuple, right? We'll come back to these examples. But that's what ignore is. It's a function that takes whatever you give it and throws it away, okay? So we're working at, like, notice here, we're talking about very, very low-level primitive things. You'll see, this is kind of the flavor of ML. We talk about, like, very simple mathematical ideas. We build up our intuitions. And that lets us build complicated programs from actually something that looks a bit more like mathematics. Okay. So here's the cool thing I love about ignore, though, or really this special operator here, which is you can, in ML, you can kind of flip things around a little bit if you want. And so it turns out this expression does the same thing as that expression above. What does that mean? Well, it turns out this thing here is called the forward pipe operator, okay? What it does is, in essence, it takes... what does it do? Let me see if I can explain this in the simplest way. It takes the result on the left-hand side, and it sort of throws it over to this function, okay? So that's what this thing does, okay? So you can use forward pipe in a lot of ways. Imagine, so you've probably done this before. You've called something like this, f of g of something, right? And which one of these things happens first? The answer is G, right, because of the way that we evaluate programs, typically. And then the next thing that happens is F. But, you know, when you read it from left to right, it's not obvious, but you have to think about it, right? So the forward pipe operator lets you write this. It's the same expression, okay? But now it reads in the order that it actually happens in. Okay? So that's what forward pipe is. So just kind of keep that one in mind. You'll discover... you probably will say, oh, that's weird, I'm not going to use that. Like, I can see you all right now saying, like, this is a strange idea. Yeah, maybe I'll come back to that. And here's what's going to happen. You're going to write something that looks a bit like this. It's really deep. And then you're going to go, that idea is going to start tickling your mind and say, like, could I really actually make this simpler in a way by using that forward pipe thing? And then hopefully you'll try it. And you'll see, oh, actually, it makes it way simpler. Okay, so... just like I said, it's sort of like it throws it off on the other side. Okay, so it's kind of like that, right? Good. Okay, so here's the thing I wanted to return to. Remember I was talking about main and it returns, like this is the Java version, sort of the Java transliteration. One thing that's worth knowing is that in F-sharp, it's actually this, right? That's how you have to write your main method. And the reason for that is that actually you're supposed to return a number to the operating system. The fact that Java doesn't do this is a little puzzling because this is part of the operating system standard we all use, which is called POSIX. It requires the main method to return 1. Let me back up. It requires the main method to return 0 if things went okay and something not 0 if things didn't go okay. Literally every computer program, like, in the world is supposed to do this, and for some reason Java made you go through an extra step to return that number. That's what system.exit does, if you've ever used that function. Anyway, Atlas.
Circling back to the forward pipe thing, so
yes.
You have like a triply nested thing like F, G, H.
Yeah.
And if, like, how many things
like forward pipe? So, F, G, H.
Yeah.
Something like that, right?
Yeah, and on the left side we have the H function, let's say, of the forward pipe.
Yep.
And on the right, we have, like, I guess, by F-sharp calling to be F and G.
So we give H to G, right?
Oh.
And then we give this to F, the whole thing to F.
I guess my question is, like, you know, I guess in F-sharp, you can just write F space G, and that would give G to F?
Ah, yes. So you could rewrite this thing. I put parens here because you're used to this, but yes, we can write this this way.
Yes. So if we have like H forward pipe, F, G, does the forward pipe just send to the...
Oh, I see. H forward pipe, F, G. What does this do? Okay, good question. Well, it evaluates H first,
yeah.
And then it attempts to give that to this.
Okay.
And that's not quite the same thing, right? Because here's what it does. It evaluates H, then it evaluates F of G, whatever that is, and then it takes whatever you got from H and it gives it to whatever F of G returned.
Oh, okay.
That's not the same thing as this. This evaluates H, gives that result to the function G, evaluates G, gives the result to the function F.
So it's not literally just taking the left-hand side and putting it at the
Not quite, line. Yeah. It's a little more complicated than that. Right? There's a sort of an order of operations. And by the way, this order of operations, I fully acknowledge, does not look like it makes sense at the moment. And that's because you have not learned the lambda calculus yet. So when you learn the lambda calculus, which is mystifying on its own, it'll all make sense because that is the logic that actually explains why these things work the way they do. For now, the thing that you need to remember is, I think this is the kind of key thing. If you have a function and it takes an argument, in F-sharp you would write it like this. And the kind of key thing to remember is that whenever you have a function next to a value, it's just a function call. Okay? What we're doing is we're dropping the parens. And the reason is, if you think about it from a logical standpoint, the parens are actually unnecessary. They're not actually saying anything except to just remind you that we like to put arguments next to functions. Well, of course we do. We always give arguments to functions. Why do we need the parens? We don't really need them, right? When we need parens for real is to make order of operations clear. But it turns out this is completely unambiguous in NL. So we don't actually need it. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
So
we found
the
FGH
here, and it means like H equals G equals.
Yeah, you mean like this right here?
Yeah.
Okay, so how does this work?
What's the difference between this one and then like having F have two parameters?
Ah, okay. Yes. Great question. Okay. So the evaluation of this does depend a little bit on the definitions of these functions. Okay. The way that I've been kind of hand-wavy explaining this is that each of these functions takes one argument. Okay. And notice I did actually omit an argument here. Let's put one here so that we have one. Okay. So what happens? Let's suppose we define all of these functions as functions that just take one argument. And let's pretend x is a value. In fact, let's not even use x, let's use y, something that's clearly a value, right? What happens? Well, the very first thing that happens is we evaluate this function, okay? So that's sort of the order that happens here. When we're done evaluating this function, we have another function that has an argument waiting for it, so then we evaluate this function. When we're done evaluating that function, so this one uses the result of that calling that function, then we evaluate this function. Does that make sense? So now it's a little bit different if you have a function that takes two arguments. So let's say for a moment f was a function that took two arguments. And right now I'm going to write this very generically. Let's say f is a function that takes an a, and it takes a b, and it returns a c. And I'll talk about what these things mean some more later, and we write that same expression, f, g, h. Well, okay, things are different now, because f is a function that takes two things. So really, we're going to evaluate that all together all at once. It's a little hard to see. By the way, I completely appreciate the feeling that this is weird and maybe uncomfortable, and all I can say at the moment is, you just need to see a lot more of it, and you need to try writing things on your own. Yeah. Remind me your name.
Charlie.
Charlie, okay.
So if there was a 1, like the example above...
Up here?
Right there, it would evaluate H of 1 and...
No. Well, okay, so let's walk through it. Let's walk through what actually happens here. So let's pretend H is a function. Let's say it takes an integer, and it returns an int. Okay. So you're right. The first thing that would happen would be this. You would evaluate this, okay? And then you get some result, let's say h is a function that adds 1. So then we kind of have the moral equivalent of this, okay? And then it would evaluate f, however we defined it. We didn't actually give it a definition here, we just gave it a type.
and that would work. So yeah, is that where you were going with that?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yes, that is exactly how it would work. Okay. Yeah.
So does F sharp like evaluate from left to right or like right to left if it starts?
Neither.
Go back?
Neither. The evaluation order, and we'll talk about this, is called normal order. It's not something you've seen before, and it'll be actually kind of hard to have an appreciation for what it is, like I said, until we talk about the lambda calculus. For now, I just want you to have an intuition, so play with it. And here's my suggestion. If you're confused, just put parens in, right? Because parens always disambiguate the order. Okay, yeah.
So for the type you say like A arrow B arrow C, is that like a logical linking from A to B even though they're both input?
Sort of, yeah. You can think of function as sort of like implication on some. I think this is what you're asking. Is it like logical implication?
It's because like we know that C is an input, right? Because like what I would assume the type to be A comma B arrows.
Oh, okay.
A arrow B.
So this is at the end of the second reading, just so you know. If you haven't gotten there yet, then you'll pick this up. But it turns out these are, when we write functions, so first, let me just give you some preliminaries. This means function, okay? That's the type for function.
Yeah.
Now functions, they always have to take an input and return an output. So whatever this is, by the way, letters with these little tick symbols next to them mean any type. Okay, so this is just a standard. You've seen any types before, right? It's actually the same idea, right? So in Java, we call them generics. In F-sharp, we call them polymorphic types. Okay, so here's a function. It takes something. For now, we're saying it can take anything. And then it has to return something. I'll put something else here. Here's another generic variable, another polymorphic variable. And the key distinction here, why did I use B? All I'm saying is it doesn't have to be the same as A. That's why I didn't use A. If I actually wrote a function that looks like this, now what I'm saying is it's a function that takes an A and must return that same type. So if I give it an integer, it has to return an integer. This one, I could give it an integer. Maybe it returns a string. Right? Okay, so your next question was, what does it mean when we have like multiple arrows? Okay. Let's change this example just a tad. All right, this is painful, but so there's a name for this. This is called a curried function. So what's actually happening here? If we call a function, let's say we have a function f and we give 1 and 2. This is a function that we would like to think of as having two arguments, right? What's actually happening when we give it that first argument 1? Here's what's actually happening. It is going to return, so let's just like think of it like one step at a time. We give this function 1. What it actually returns is another function that expects another argument, okay? So if we give it, let's say, and let me make these even super, super clear. And, you know, so I'll leave this here. Let me erase something and just write it all out so it's like crystal clear, right? So let's say I have a function, we'll call it f, and okay, everybody, oh, sorry, not 1 plus 2, a plus b. Everybody knows what this function does, hopefully, right? If I give it 1 and 2, I should get 3. There should be no surprise there. So let's say we call this f, 1, 2. So hopefully I should get 3. Here's how F-sharp actually evaluates this. It says, let's give it this function f, my first argument 1. And it does that. And what it does is it sort of generates a new function, and that new function has this form. So I'm going to leave out the name of the function for the moment. Okay? So what this is now, what it returns, is a function that is waiting for one more argument so that it can add it to this. Okay? That's why, if you look at this definition, this is a function that takes an A and returns another function. That function is now expecting a B. Likewise up here, right, the type of this is going to be int, int, int. If you give it a 1, it's going to give you back a function that expects one more integer, and if you do finally give it that last integer, you'll get an integer back. And that's what happens here, right? If we then give it the 2, we should get 3, finally. So what this does, so this is the weird thing. This is the thing that I think you probably are struggling with. In a functional programming language, the arguments are, the function is sort of divisible by the arguments. You can split it up into pieces. You say, I'm going to give you this argument. Please give me whatever I'm supposed to get back if I gave you that argument. If you think about this from a math standpoint, what we're doing is we're saying, if we give it that first argument, I'd like to fix A to be 1. So give me the function I would get if I fixed A to be 1. Well, what you get back is a function that's waiting for one more argument, B. If you do give it 1 and 2, you'll get back 3, because there's no free variables anymore, right? Like, there's no parameters that are not unfixed, right? Does that make sense? So this is a really foreign concept, right? Like, we tend not to think of programs as math, but these are math, okay? All right, so we'll come back to this. I know this is not comfortable idea, but we'll kind of return to it. Let's go back to our comfort zone, primitives. All right, so can anybody here like rattle off the primitives from Java off the top of their head? Int? String? Not string.
Oh.
Short?
Byte.
Float. Oh, sorry, what was it?
Float.
Float, yes, float.
Car.
Yes.
Car,
char, whatever you want to call it.
Long.
Long.
Double.
Long, long. Long, long is actually not in Java, believe it or not, but it is in C. Somebody said something else. Boolean. Yeah, okay. There's actually one more, believe it or not, in Java that is like not obvious. Reference. So that's pointer, right? But, you know, it kind of makes sense on some level. Yeah, that one's like, really? Come on. It turns out, and pointer is like a reference is just a memory address, right? It's like where the object lives in memory. Okay. So those are the primitives in Java, right? And I think we all feel pretty comfortable with those. Well, fortunately, right, F-sharp's not so foreign. It has primitives too, right? And it has the ones that you just described, right? The names are maybe slightly different, but they're basically the same thing. Is there one more? And then unit. Unit, it adds unit, because nothing is obviously primitive. You can't split it up. And that's really the idea with a primitive, right? You can't divide it into anything else. So classes, right, are made out of pieces, or tuples are made out of pieces, right? So they're not primitive, but these things are primitive. Yes.
What's a single?
Oh, so in F-sharp, they don't call it float, they call it single. Actually, this is kind of an annoying thing. If you type in float, it means double by default, just to be totally confusing. So single is what we would call float in a regular language. It's a single precision floating point number. Double is a double precision floating point number. Who's taken 237 in this class? I guess the more important question is who hasn't taken 237? Okay, a few. So you know, you'll learn a little bit of what these things mean when you take 237. The main idea is that these are pretty close to like the machine representations, right? So here's the basic idea, right? A single precision floating point number uses 32 bits to represent the number. A double precision floating point number uses 64, actually in practice it's 48, but we pretend it's 64 bits to represent the number. And what is the consequence of that? It means that you can represent a longer fraction, basically. Okay? But it turns out, I just want to point this out, F-sharp is a very rich programming environment, and it has even more primitives. Because you might have encountered this thing in Java, especially if you've used C at all. So those of you who have taken 237 know that there's like this subtlety, right? There's a difference between an integer and an unsigned integer, right? You can leave the sign off and use one extra bit for storage, right? And in Java, you can't do that, which is kind of annoying, right? Because you know that the machine can natively handle it. So F-sharp actually has some more primitives so that you can very precisely say exactly how much storage you want, right? So we have, for example, S-byte is short byte, which is actually a nibble. It's half of a byte. We have 16-bit numbers. We have 64-bit numbers. These are also, by the way, these are pointers. So we have a lot of control over what happens. Just so you know, in this class, we probably won't really use these over here. And the other thing that's worth noting is that these aren't actually defined by F-sharp language. They're defined by this thing called the CLR. That's what the language runs on top of. It's the same thing that C-sharp runs on top of. Okay, so you probably have heard these terms before. So you know what Java is. Does anybody know what Java runs on top of? Atlas. The Java Virtual Machine. And the Java Virtual Machine is the layer that makes it so that we don't have to change our Java programs when we move them from one computer architecture to another, because we have this virtual machine that pretends like it's a computer, right? Well, it turns out that F-sharp and C-sharp are the same story. These languages run on top of a virtual machine, and that virtual machine is called the CLR, which stands for Common Language Runtime. And remember how I said that C-sharp was like pretty much a clone of Java? Well, before C-sharp, before F-sharp invented, you know, was invented, this was the story, right? And this language looks really like a lot like that one, and this looked almost exactly like this too. These have all diverged over the years. It's been 20 years since Microsoft got sued for doing that, just so you know. So they're no longer the same, but it's the similar idea, okay? All right, so, right. There's this one that's really cool, decimal. That's a really interesting data type to have because, as you know, we often represent numbers in a computer using binary. This actually represents it in a decimal form, which is weird. And if you actually happen to have a computer that has hardware decimal support, the CLR will use it, which is cool. If it doesn't, it kind of emulates it. But anyway, okay. Primitives. Okay, so we're comfortable with primitives, hopefully. There's just a few more that we get to use if you want to. Remember in WICMA the other day, I talked about combining forms. And combining forms, the way I kind of pitched it to you was, think of it as like verbs, right? Or maybe adjectives or adverbs, right? Things that let you take a primitive and say something more about it or combine it with other primitives, right? So like, you know, the dog eats its food, right? We're talking about two primitive things, dogs and food on some level, and we're combining them with this verb that says that it eats. And there's also other words in there, and I'm not a linguist, so I don't know what those are. Anyway, okay, so let's go back to functions real quick. Functions are a combining form, right? So if I'm in the REPL and I type in something like this, hopefully now that we've talked about it a little bit, this is not the most foreign thing to you. What might look a little foreign to you, though, is the type that it prints out. So I know you're already feeling angry at me for making you talk about polymorphic types. But this doesn't even look like the thing that we wrote on the board, right? So what is it? Well, let's just work through it a little bit so you can see. So I'm going to write let foo a, b, c equal a. So just out of curiosity, I'll leave, by the way, these double semicolons are just for the purposes of the interpreter so it knows that you're done typing something in. In a program that you write outside of the interpreter, like a standalone program, you don't need those double semicolons. Okay, so if I were to write this, does anybody want to tell me what I would get back as a result? Yeah.
One.
Yeah, exactly. I should get one back. You want to tell me how you figured that out?
One is being put in the same argument as A.
That's right.
And you get A back.
And the function is just defined as something that returns A. So here's the first thing, in case you haven't already picked this up. We don't ever say return in a function, because functions always return something. So it just returns whatever the last thing was in the program. This is the last thing in the function, so it just returns A. So what this function does is it sort of just selects, you give it three arguments for whatever reason, right? And then it selects A out of those three arguments. And by the way, there are good reasons for doing things like this. It's probably not obvious yet. But. Okay, so what is the type of this function? Well, let's write down what the interpreter told us the type was. It said we have this value called foo, and foo looks like this. So I'm just going to copy it because I don't even remember how it generates these things. Did I do that? Yeah, okay. And then C. And then A. Okay. I mean, this looks just horrible, right? So let's do the first thing. So just so you know, the horribleness is on some level because F-sharp is trying to help you. And the way it's trying to help you is to remind you
that the argument A, for example, is of type tick A. Okay? So let's rewrite this, maybe some way that makes a little more sense, and say that foo is a function that is defined as, let's leave out the helpful bits, tick A, tick B, tick C. And that makes sense. It makes a little more sense, right? Because if you think about it, so in the example I gave you, where I gave you 1, 2, 3, and you said it returned 1, let me ask you this. Could I do this? Is this okay? You know, and let me actually use different words. So, hi, Joe, there. Can I also call foo with these arguments? Yeah. Why do you think that's okay?
Because it doesn't really matter as long as it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, your logic was exactly right. It doesn't matter unless, wait, there's no unless, right? All it does is it takes that whatever that first argument and does and returns it. So there's no unless. It's, we could give it a string and it should return it. In fact, so what we'll get back is hi. Here, we can even do this, foo, you know, 3, character A, string hi, because it doesn't say anything about the types. They can be anything, and that's what this type definition says. A could be anything, B could be anything, C could be anything. And when I say anything, B doesn't have to be the same type as A. Could be. C doesn't have to be the same type as B. Could be. Right? Could be any of these things. It's totally free form. Yeah?
Can it be nothing? Unit.
That's a good question. I actually don't know the answer to that off the top. I think the answer is yes, but let's try it. Let's see what happens. So if I say let foo A, B, C equals A, I mean, unit is a value of type unit, and unit is a type, so hopefully we can give foo a unit. Oh, interesting. Oh, wait, we were supposed to give it three things, right? So let's try this again. So 1, 2, 3 does the right thing. Let's give it unit as one of them. Okay, yeah, it does work. So we could give it a unit here. We give it a unit here. Okay. Just briefly returning to this idea of curried functions, let me just show you something interesting, which is if I call foo now and I just give it one argument. Oh, wait, why is this complaining? Oh, okay. This does work. But what F sharp is telling me is that it needs a little bit of help with the function. So let's define something a little more clearly. So let's say bar. I'm now going to define this. I'm going to give it some types to just help it out. A, I'm going to say these are now very specifically integers. All right, so this is the same kind of thing that I did before, but now I'm saying I've constrained the types a little bit. Okay. If I call bar and I give it one argument, notice what I get back is now a function. Okay, so if I call bar with 1, 2, 3, we're not surprised at what we get because we just worked through what it's supposed to do. We're supposed to get 1 back. We're maybe a little surprised if we give it one thing, but let's give it that one thing and then save that result, okay, off on the side. Let's call that x. So if the thing I told you before was right, that if you have a function that expects 3 arguments and you give it 1, what you should get back now is a function that expects 2 arguments, right? So if that's true, we should be able to give x one more argument, or maybe 2 more arguments. And hey, look, we get 1 back, okay? Or we could even, you know, let's just take this even further. We should get a function back that now expects 1 argument. And if we then call that function with that 1 remaining argument, we get that same thing back, okay? So this really does work. Now, that thing that we saw before, this like horrible pile of stuff, just so you know, this will pop up. This is called value restriction. This has nothing to do with the validity of the logic we just did. What it means is that F sharp has some trouble inferring what the type is supposed to be under certain conditions. This is actually a restriction in the logic that they used for the language. It's actually, turns out F sharp, for performance reasons, cut a couple corners, okay? It's totally practical. People want their programs to be fast. They don't really want to wait a really, really, really long time for things to happen. So they cut a couple corners on the logic. And all this means is that it actually cannot always do this kind of fully general logical thing when you leave the types totally undefined. Sometimes it'll pop up. And by the way, it's a little unpredictable when this happens. And all you have to do is say, okay, you know what, here's what I expect back from you. And then it will say, okay, you wanted an integer. Great, I think we're okay then. So just keep that in mind if you see this. It's not, it doesn't mean that there's actually a bug in your logic. It just means it's a limitation of the language. Okay, good. All right, how are we doing on time? We're done at 10 past, right? Is that right? Okay, good. All right, so this is no surprise to all of you. We just kind of worked through this. Okay, let's talk about other combining forms. Some useful things that you would probably like to have right away in other languages. And like Python has this, right? So we can say, here's a tuple, right? I'm going to put in three things. You probably know that tuples don't have to have the same type for every element in the tuple. And notice what we get back as a type when we define this. It figured out that A was a string. It figured out that 1 was an integer. It figured out that 4.4 was a floating point number. Okay? Now, there is one thing here, though, right? Tuples, they do have a structure to them. Once you've defined it, let's say, you know, string int float, right? You can't add extra things to it. That's now has a different type. So, for example, if I go back over to my REPL here, and I say, so I did 1, high, 4.4, something like that, right? Get that same type. If I want an extra thing in here, let's say, you know, let's put in a character, right? This is a different type. It's a different kind of tuple, okay? Because tuples do have a type. They're statically typed. Anyway, okay. So, all right, so then we can define a function that takes it, and one thing that you, so this is why I wanted to talk a little bit about curried functions. This is sort of what you might think of as a function that takes three arguments, right? Does that make sense? It's not a function that takes three arguments. It's a function that takes one. That one argument is a tuple. So there's a sort of nice, I guess, connection to what you already know. This language is much more general. Right? You can say, here's a function that takes three arguments. You can put it in curried form, and then you can divide up that function. Why you want to do that is probably not obvious to you just yet, but you'll see. And I hate to do this, but we're going to defer the killer application to the second half of the semester. So remember I told you we're kind of in the eating vegetables phase. So, you know, we're eating some vegetables at the moment. You'll see the killer application in the second half of the course, and you'll use it a lot. It's something called a parser combinator. In any case, this is, if you just write the kind of functions the way you would expect them to see in a traditional language, it devolves into something that makes sense in F#, because what we're actually saying is, here's a function that takes one argument, that one argument happens to be a tuple. And you can use those values inside there, just like you would use them in any other function, because you told it that they have names, right? The first thing of the tuple is called A, the second part is called B, the third part is called C. Yeah, John.
Are the stars like indicative that it's a tuple?
Yes. Star means tuple. Okay. Yeah, great. So thanks for pointing that out. So this bit right here, and let's do that same exercise that we did over here. We just write this back down and remove the helpful bits, right? So it told us that Baz was A string star int. Wait, am I doing this right? B int star C float. So if we rewrite this to remove the helpful parts, it's saying that Baz, oh, and there's a function thing in here, right? And that I missed, it returns a float. Is that right? Oh no, it returns a lot. I'm just gonna do that for the moment, right? I don't wanna rewrite all that stuff. So string, string star int star float, and then it returns something. Does that make sense? Yeah, blue.
Is it any more efficient to give it one or the other? Like, if you were to have like two in.
Yeah. The short answer is no. They're basically the same. The more complicated answer is that probably the tupled form is a little bit more efficient, but it's so negligible that you shouldn't think about it that way. Yeah. You had a question in the back. No?
Yeah, I was just wondering if
Okay, yeah, John.
I don't know if you know the answer to this, but why? Like, what was the design decision? Like, why would they use stars rather than like commas? Is there like another use for commas in the language? Or is that just
that's a good question.
Is that just the way it is?
Let me think about it for a second. Does comma have a meaning? So I can tell you about parens. You can use parens in types. So parens are out because you can actually use parens just for grouping like you would ordinarily. So you don't want to say anything about a tuple having to do with parens. Why commas? I actually don't know the answer to that. There isn't some other use as far as I'm aware. So yeah, they could have done that. Maybe that would have been easier to read. I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
It's a good question. Homework assignment for you. Extra homework for you.
All right.
Okay. Okay. So, all right. Here's another combining form, which is called a record. Because you might be thinking, all right, tuples are useful, but like I sort of, you know, I've used classes before, and classes are definitely useful because you can give things names and so on and so forth. So in F sharp, we have something called a record. If you've done C programming before, think of a record as a struct. And in case you don't know, both in Java and in C++, object-oriented languages, they build classes on top of structs. So they are sort of the same. So here's how we would define a type for a record. So what I'm saying is here is there's a type called point, and it has three fields. It has one called x, which is an integer. It has one called y, which is an integer. And it has one called z, which is an integer. Makes sense, right? Here's a three-dimensional point. Everybody clear about this? There's really nothing special here. So I've just defined it now. I'm not using it yet. If I want to use it, I'd write, so, and if I hit enter, this is what it will return to me. If I want to actually use it now, I could type in something like this, and I'll actually get a p, and it will know that I meant point, because I said earlier that a point has this thing. Now, this is kind of interesting, because you could define another type that has exactly the same parameters. Which one will it choose? Turns out it chooses the first one that you said, because it actually knows that those types are the same, right? So if I said, I don't know, zoinks, type zoinks, right? It's all exactly the same. Point and zoinks are the same. The language will know that. Okay? Yeah?
So if you use the equal sign comparator and you compare the two?
You can't compare types.
Okay. Okay.
You can only compare values. But yes, you could make something up. You could make a point P and like a zoink Z, and if they have the same values and they compare them, yeah, that'll work. Okay. Totally. Yep. Okay, so here's me defining a function, right? This might be useful if you're like making a game, right? So let's say I have a point on the grid and I want to know what's the point above it. Okay, so here's what I'm doing. Here's a we know it's a function because when you look at the equal sign, there's an extra parameter here, right? So there's something undefined. It's a function called up that takes something called pt. And then what it returns is a record. And you can see what the record is so x is whatever pt was, whatever pt's x was, okay? So this is just like the syntax in Java in a way. If you think of these as kind of like classes or structs in C, I'm saying x is whatever pt's x was, y is whatever pt's y was, plus 1, and then z is whatever pt's z was. Does this make sense? I'm literally saying here's a point, it's a function, take a point, find the point above it. Right, in kind of Y space. Or it kind of depends on which direction your coordinates go, but I'm thinking of as like bigger is higher. Any confusion about this at all? No? Okay, so if I define that function, right, notice it figures out that it's a function from a point to a point, and I call it with the point that we declared before, P, then I get a new point back. And that point is the same as the one I had before, but Y is one bigger. Okay? So I like this. I think that this is great because look how simple these functions are, right? I took something that, I mean, how much programming would you have to do in Java to define a class for a point and then, like, does this very simple thing? You'd have to write a lot of stuff, and you don't have to write a lot of stuff here. So that's what I like about this. Okay. Questions before we move on? Okay, good. All right, here's another data structure. Hopefully you're all familiar with this one because you've all taken 136 is a prereq. So, and I know the front row over here took it with me, so I can vouch for them. All right, so for you guys, you've probably even seen this definition of a list before because this is my slide from 136. Okay, so a linked list. It's a recursive data structure, as you know. And it has this really beautiful, elegant definition. By the way, I feel like the dummy lists lab completely loses all of the elegance of this definition. but, you know, it does have dummy in the name. So a list is either one of two things. It's either empty or it's a node pointing at another list, right? And so this works because you could have a list that has nothing in it. It's empty. You could have a list that has one thing in it. It's a list that has that one thing, and then it points at the empty list. You could have a list that has two things in it. So that's a list with a node, with a thing. It points at the next list. It's pointing at a list of one thing. That one thing points at a list of no things, right? So I like this, right? And by the way, I'll just use symbols like this in the future when we talk about these things. So I like to think about the empty list as like this little symbol. In F sharp, we call it nil. Is it the same thing as null? Sort of, right? It doesn't have literally the same representation in the computer, but if you need to think about it as null, sure. Basically the same idea. Okay, so, and then here's the other idea, right? A list is like a box that stores a value and then points at another list, right? And so using these pieces, we can make lists of arbitrary size, right? Hopefully this matches the intuition you already have for linked lists, right? There's no surprising anything here? Okay, good. So a list has parts. You probably already know this part's called the head. And if you took 136 with us, we told you that this was the tail. I just want you to know this is not correct. I've argued with the department about this until I'm blue in the face. That's not the tail. This is the tail, right? Tails are long, right? Like, okay, I guess it's a little weird. You've probably never seen an animal with a tail sticking out of its head, but that's how we think about them in functional programming, okay? A list is a head that has a tail sticking out of it, okay? So just remember that these are slightly different than what we told you before. The list is not, I mean, the tail is the end, but it's everything after the head, okay? All right, so let's just use some examples real quick. So this is the empty list. It's just open, close bracket. If you've programmed in Python, that should be a little familiar to you. If we want to make a list that has, so here are two lists. I'm just kind of writing them next to each other. Here's a list full of numbers, right? Here's a list full of strings. Again, this is almost exactly like Python. The one key difference being we're using semicolons now instead of commas, okay? And by the way, the semicolon comma thing trips up everybody. In fact, I forget it all the time. I don't know why they picked semicolons. They just did. Okay, here's the thing, though. All of the elements of the list in a given list have to have the same type. This is true in Java, right? When you make a list and you say it's going to store integers, what you're saying is this list, every element of the list is an integer. So that rule is the same in F sharp. Just so you know, this is actually one of these things that doesn't have to be this way. We could make lists that have elements of different types. That's called a heterogeneous list. And Lisp, which we're not talking about just yet, the precursor to F sharp, it had that, heterogeneous lists. The problem is we don't yet know a good mathematical foundation for reasoning about heterogeneous lists. We literally don't have what's called a type theory for it. So we can't make programs, if we decide we want to have heterogeneous lists in the programming language, we can't have static data types anymore. It's kind of one or the other. That's a little disappointing. But it turns out that we don't really need heterogeneous lists all that often, so this is fine, right? Okay, so what are some operations? Yeah, Nachman.
Do you make an exception to that, or like, is there any way to make the value null?
Nope. Yeah, and in fact, here's one thing. I don't know if you've noticed this. There isn't really null in this language. And you're really, really discouraged from using null at all. And nil, so here's one thing. What type is null? This is a good question for you. What type is null? What is it?
Unit.
I mean in like Java. What is it?
None type.
None type. Nope. Char is not nullable. Sorry. String is nullable. So here's the thing. This is weird. This is what makes null bad. Null has no type. Or rather, there are different kinds of null. So string is nullable, right? Because you can write string s equals null. Let's say we had a person class. Person p equals null. Are these the same type of null? The answer is no. But the language gives you no way of knowing that or reasoning about that at all. The people who designed F-sharp said, this is a terrible idea. We're just not going to have null, right? Because it doesn't let you reason about what these values actually are. So nil, very specifically, is an empty list, okay? It is not, has nothing to do with strings, has nothing, you can't repurpose it for some other thing. It's very specifically the empty list, okay? So that's a little foreign, but worth knowing. Okay, so not surprisingly, we have some operations that we can call on lists, right? We want to be able to get, you know, the length of a list. So if you call list length and you give it a list, you get, you know, like that, you get three back. Cons. Now, think of cons as prepend. When we talk about Lisp, you'll hear where this word comes from. But we often talk about consing something to a list. What we mean is prepending. And just so you know, this term cons is used like universally in functional programming. So just be aware that what we're doing is, so notice we're taking one, which is not a list. So if you look at the types of this expression, the left-hand side of this operation is an element of value. The right-hand side is a list. And what we're doing is we're prepending that to that list. Okay? Head. So this is going back to our diagram. If you give it a list, it just gives you back the thing in the head. Notice the head is not a list. This is also a difference between the definition we gave you before. It reaches inside that node and takes the value out of the node, right? So one is not a list. It's the value inside the list. Okay? Tail, it's going to give us, this is going to give us a list. It's everything after the head. Append. Okay, so append looks a little bit weird. Notice that the append, so append is this little at sign. It has something on the left, it has something on the right. Both of those things are lists, and what you get back is a list. And then this is something I'm going to save until next class, but I'm just going to tell you right now. There's this awesome function called map, okay? And we're going to use map a lot. Your next homework assignment is going to have map in it. What map does is it takes a function and a list and returns a new list. And what it does is it takes this function and it applies it to every element of the list. So suck here stands for successor. It's just plus one, okay? Not doesn't literally suck, right? So it's taking and adding one to one, one to two, one to three. Hey, look what we get back. We get back a list that has two, three, four. Okay, I think that's good enough for today. Hopefully that'll give you enough to talk about, to do your upcoming programming assignment. We're going to talk about more F-sharp next week.